For millennia, before we even had a pharmaceutical industry, humans found healing properties in the plants around them. As we all know, many of the chemical compounds found in pharmaceuticals were isolated from plants. Scott Kluse is the founder and managing director of the School of Forest Medicine and the author of a new book, Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. We have amazing biodiversity in our region, and the book provides a guide to 120 wild remedies. Scott's giving a presentation tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. Scott, good morning.
Hey, good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. So we have this guide here, and it's very well illustrated with lots of photographs so that you can identify these plants as you're heading out into the woods for these remedies. But what are the sources of the information? For example, when you publish that, say, silk tassel is a good remedy for menstrual cramps, how has that information come down to you? How's that determined?
Well, for many years, people have been studying these plants. Some of the information has come from the native peoples of the region who've used these plants for millennia, and a lot of what we know now about the plants here came from people such as Michael Moore, who wrote a book called Medicinal Plants of the Pacific West, and he did a lot of study. He was one of the pioneers of rebirthing the practice of herbalism in the United States, particularly in the Western United States. We lost much of our traditions when we shifted to a more pharmaceutical approach, but people in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s have been bringing it back, and now we have a pretty flourishing community of plant medicine people.
So I know a lot of the herbal medicine as it's practiced in Europe, for example, is fairly mainstream, and a lot of these herbs have been studied scientifically. Has that been the case as well in the United States?
Well, some of the herbs have been, but a lot of the scientific knowledge that we have, at least scientific in the terms of like peer-reviewed studies and such, comes from Europe. Because, like you said, it's more of a mainstream accepted form of medicine, and it's integrated with the allopathic practice. But here in the United States, because of the systems that have developed from the American Medical Association and the pharmaceutical companies, there hasn't been as much research because you can't patent a plant medicine. People don't want to put the time and the effort and the money into researching something that they can't profit from. So, in a sense, it's good for us in a way because the medicine stays in the hands of the people, and then we do the research ourselves. And we herbalists for years now, like I said, have been studying these plants and seeing how they work in the clinical setting, in the home setting, and in the field.
So people approaching your book from a maybe more typical allopathic perspective might have a difficult time with some of the medical terms you use in the book. Some of them are very, very common and easily understood. But, for example, I saw one plant that was to be used for damp stagnation. And I thought, well, what the heck is that? Is that something that a practitioner of natural medicine would understand?
Yeah, more and more. I mentioned that, the practice of herbalism was revived in the 60s and the 70s. And when it first started coming back, we didn't have an intact sort of system of medicine, a foundation upon which we could determine what remedies were useful for what types of conditions. So a lot of the information was put into tables like, oh, this herb's good for the liver, this good herb for this, this herb's good for that. But there wasn't really indications for which liver herb you'd use for what type of liver condition. And the term damp stagnation refers to, fluids in the body that aren't flowing properly. And a lot of this knowledge about how to work with plants in this way, in a way that's connected to the actual functioning of the organism, came to us through people like Matthew Wood, who revived the Greek tradition of hot, dry, damp, and cold. And from just those four things, which is sort of the basis of Greek medicine and a lot of the folk traditions from around the world, we can say, okay, so there's coldness in the body, and and there's dampness in the body. So we give an herb that is warming and drying. A good example of that would be angelica. There's a beautiful species of angelica that grows down in southern Oregon called Angelica arguta, sharp-tooth angelica that I talk about in the book. And that people that have constitutionally damp stagnation in their system will tend to get lots of lung infections when the weather turns cold and damp in the wintertime. And so if you want to stave that off, you can start taking something like, you know, tea or a tincture of the dried root of sharp-tooth angelica, and it will help your body begin to warm and dry itself, and then you prevent the chronic infection.
Scott Gluse is our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about his new book, Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. He's the founder and managing director of the School of Forest Medicine. You can join the discussion by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe there's some medicinal plants that you have questions about. Scott, I bet, can answer them for you. Now, Scott, in the beginning part of your book, you have a lot of instructions on how to actually go out in the woods and forage or wildcraft these herbs and medicinal plants. You talk about foraging and wildcrafting. Are those terms synonymous?
Foraging is mostly used for edible plants, plants that are just used as food, and then wildcrafting is more refers to plants used for medicine.
And so those would be plants that you would then harvest in the wild, but then have to create into, say, a tincture or a tea. You'd actually take some extra steps to before you actually ingested those herbs.
Yeah, and some things you can use right in the field. You know, like plantain is a great example. You can, if this is a good one for everybody to know, because if you get, let's say, you get stung by a bee, and you're susceptible to getting like a reaction to it, whether it's swelling or maybe some, in extreme cases, people could go into anaphylactic shock. That plantain, if you just chew the leaf up, and we call it a spit poultice, chew that up and put that on the site of the sting, it will draw the venom out, and then it will prevent, I've had it prevent, like, I haven't gotten any swelling, and I've seen that happen with many, many people who like, for me, my hand will swell up like into like the size of a grapefruit if I get stung, but using that plant helps alleviate that.
Well, as we're heading into yellow jacket season, that's really good information. So you also have a lot of information for people who are getting ready to head into the woods. What are some of the basic things somebody should know if they buy your book and they're ready to go out and harvest some medicinal plants?
Well, the first thing to know is to, you know, before you even head out or even with the thought of wildcrafting and harvesting plants in the wild, there's some very important things to consider. Number one is just our impact on the wild populations. We've had, a history all over the world of things being over-harvested and a misunderstanding of how much we can harvest without affecting the ecosystem. So I recommend that people just go and spend time in wild nature to really start to gain an understanding of how everything is interconnected. The plants that, you know, provide food for other animals. That each plant also has its role in the ecosystem. Everything is harmonized. And so if we take too much of a plant, we can upset that delicate balance. So really to be mindful of that, and then also to be aware of the plants that are considered to be endangered or threatened in the wild. And in the book, I give some resources for that from the Forest Service and also United Plant Savers, a group that helps bring awareness to plants such as these. And then to be aware of the toxic plants. So there are some plants out there that most plants are perfectly safe to eat and to consume. But there's some that are toxic in the sense that they'll have adverse effects that might make some people ill, and then there's some that can actually kill you. So to be intimately aware of those plants that could potentially make you very sick or could actually kill you. So in the book, I go over those pretty in depth.
Yeah, you have a good list and some good illustrations and photographs of those plants to be avoided. We have an email here from Boyd in Wolf Creek. He wants to know, what is the best medicinal lichen guide for the Pacific Northwest, specifically how to separate the usneas and the antibiotic properties of Usnea philippendula. I hope I got that scientific name correct.
Well, I don't know of any book that's specific to the lichens of the Northwest. There are some good ID books out there. I think there's one called Macro Lichens of the Pacific Northwest that I have. But in my book, I go over Usnea and lungwort are the two lichens I have in the book. And for Usnea, the process is a little different than making a normal tincture, in that you need heat to extract a portion of the medicinal properties. So you grind the dried herb, put it in distilled water. You know, in the book it gives the measurements for that, and then heat that on a very low heat for a period of time, and then after that you add the alcohol. You don't want to heat the alcohol because it can be dangerous. So that's the way to get the full spectrum of the medicine of Usnea.
Well, that brings up another question I had, Scott Kluse. You talk about various ways of preparing these herbs and medicinal plants, and there's an infusion, which I think we all know is like brewing a tea. But then you talk about tinctures and oils. What's the difference, and how do you prepare those?
Well, tea you can use fresh plant material, but generally use dried plant material. And it's a great effective way, especially to get nutrients and minerals from the plants, because in the tinctures you don't really get so much of the mineral content. But I really like tinctures myself, because especially when you make it from the fresh plant, because in that moment you're kind of taking a snapshot of that plant's chemistry. There's no heat that goes into that alters the chemistry of the plant. So you kind of get the as best as you can, a direct link to the fresh plant. And then the tinctures are a convenient way also of consuming the medicine, because then you can, you know, carry them around in little tincture bottles with you wherever you go, and you don't have to worry about, you know, heating up your tea or making, you know, the tea that way. And they're effective in different ways. Like the tea, like I said, the teas, you know, teas are good for the full range of medicinal benefits, but they're especially good for, like, the tonic effects. Tinctures are good in that way, too. They can be, but they're also really good for acute stuff, because the alcohol goes right into the bloodstream and gets the medicine to you more quickly and efficiently.
Our guest today is Scott Kluse, who's the founder and managing director of the School of Forest Medicine and the author of a new book called Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. We're talking about the amazing array of biodiversity and the 120 wild remedies that are outlined in his book. Scott's giving a presentation tonight, by the way, at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. And in some cases, we were talking about tinctures. There are recommendations for certain plants where you want people to make the tincture right there out in the woods.
Yeah, I prefer to, you know, make the medicine as fresh as possible. So when I say that, sometimes people think I mean like carrying, you know, like jars of alcohol out into the, you know, in a backpack. I don't mean that fresh. I mean, you know, at the trailhead, at the car, wherever it is that you know, you go. But bringing the plant material back there and then doing it right there in the forest, for me, it's the best. I'd much rather be out as much as possible than doing things at home.
You could join the conversation, by the way, with Scott Kluse by calling us at 800-838-3760, or you can send in an email for the broadcast this morning at jx@jeffnet.org. So can we talk about some of the remedies that I saw in this book that kind of surprised me in terms of just really common plants that are growing around the area that I had no idea had medicinal properties? For example, cottonwood trees.
Oh yeah, cottonwood is one of the best medicines to know. It has so many useful properties. So it's the buds of the plant that we use, and it's the first thing harvested in the late winter and early spring. It's the first thing that's available for harvest, and those buds can be made into a tincture, which has anti-inflammatory properties, pain-relieving properties, and also can help reduce fevers. Also, it has the resins have a great effect on the lungs, so for clearing mucus from the lungs and increasing the flow of blood and bringing warmth to the lungs. It's one of the best for that. I mean, if you have like, if you think about the stickiness of the buds, and you have like a really sticky mucusy cough where you like you're trying to cough and nothing's coming up. I've used it to great effect to help people bring up, you know, that stuck rattling mucus.
Is there any use for the actual cotton in the springtime, which is a real nuisance?
Yeah, no, not that I know of. Just a reminder that you missed the buds for this year, and you might want to pay attention for next year.
Okay, for our folks, go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, and then other uses topically. It's one of the best things for muscle pain, strains, and bruises. You can make an oil from it, and then rub that oil, and makes a great massage oil. It smells so good, and helps bring warmth and reduces inflammation and pain in the muscles as well.
Here's one for our listeners on the east side of the Cascades: sagebrush. I didn't know sagebrush had medicinal purposes.
Yeah, sagebrush. It's in the Artemisia genus, so it has similar properties to more famous, you know, medicinal herbs like wormwood and mugwort, and it's a really good anti-parasitic remedy, and also helps the same way like mugwort helps with dreaming. It can help increase the dreaming capacity and just kind of like opening up that the unconscious aspects of the mind.
And California poppies.
Yes. That is an excellent, you know, it has the name poppy in it, and it's related to the opium poppy, though it doesn't have the same alkaloids in it. It doesn't have opium in it, but it has other pain-relieving properties. So it's a really good, gentle, pain-relieving herb, suitable for use with children even, and calming, and can help with insomnia.
And so in that case, how would you prepare it? Do you just actually eat the flower, or do you make a tincture?
You can eat the flower and get the effect. The strongest form is the roots, but I recommend using the whole plant when it's after the seed pods have started to develop. Harvest the whole plant, roots, leaves, stems, seed pods, and if there's flowers present, the flowers too. And you can dry that for a tea, although it's not what most people would consider a good tasting herb. It's fairly bitter, so the tincture it might be a better way to administer it. And if you're giving it to children, you can mix the tincture with some honey, or put a lot of honey in the tea to administer it.
Scott Kloos is our guest this morning, the founder and managing director of the School of Forest Medicine, author of Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. If you have questions about medicinal plants, give us a call. Join the discussion at 800-838-3760 or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I understand that quaking aspen also is a really good tree, has some medicinal purposes as well.
Yes. Yes, it's great. Before I talk about that, I want to just say that my name is pronounced close.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
That's okay. Everybody gets it wrong, but I just wanted to make it clear. Okay. So aspen. Aspen is one of my favorite plants. It's quite useful for digestive issues. It's very bitter, and so it stimulates the digestion and remedies that are really bitter. And when I learned this from Matthew Wood, an herbalist from the Midwest, is that the herbs that are so bitter they make you shiver have an effect on the autonomic nervous system. And so aspen helps with the digestive part of that, the relax and digest part, but it also has an effect on anxiety. And oftentimes anxiety can have a root cause of of stored traumas, and those traumas create a dissonance where the heart and the mind are kind of in a state of disconnect, and then we get anxious. And so this plant helps to align those two and helps resolve the anxiety by getting at the root of it, which is that feeling of disconnect.
Mm-hmm. And the quaking aspen, the properties are in the bark?
The bark, yes, it's the bark. The bark. And barks are harvested. Now is a good time to harvest barks. You want to harvest them after the leaves emerge. That's when the sap is running. And quaking aspen bark is really interesting in that if you look at it really closely, you know, it's whitish, but there's a slight green tinge. And there's a layer of photosynthetic bark. So all through the winter, even when there's no leaves, the tree is able to photosynthesize and produce energy for itself.
We're going to take a call here from Peter in Ashland. And let's see here. Good morning, Peter. You're on the air with Scott Close, the author of Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. What's your question?
Good morning. Before I get to my question, I want to ask, when you take that bark from the aspen trees, as long as you just don't go all the way around the tree is not damaged by it?
That's true. Yeah, I would say an even better way is to harvest a branch. Any branch that's thicker than your thumb will produce good medicine, and that way you don't do harm to the tree. And then an even further step is what I like to do is find branches that have either broken a little bit, but they're still attached by the bark so that there's still life in there, uh-huh. Or find a tree that's fallen over and is laying on its side. And if you cut that tree at the base, it will resprout, and then you can get the medicine from the trunk. Yeah, but yeah. Most of us, the branches are enough.
Okay, that'll be it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Thanks so much for your calls and emails. And thanks to Scott Close for being with us, author of Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants. Scott's giving a presentation tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. Thanks again, Scott.
All right. Thank you, John.